The bearded babies, who I hope are having a well-deserved rest and some chow, are somewhere around here. I want to thank them for providing this wonderful music for us. I know that the person I'm introducing next, Kathleen Finneran, and I feel special attachment to this kind of music, which comes from Ireland. And I do want to introduce Kathleen as our first reader tonight. She is a graduate of Washington University of the English Department, which is also where I studied when I was in school there. She lives here in St. Louis. She is author of a much praised memoir, The Tenderland, A Family Love Story, which is published by Houghton Mifflin, and for which she won the Whiting Writers Award in nonfiction. Her essays also appear in two anthologies, The Place That Holds Our History and Seeking St. Louis, Voices from a River City. Kathleen, as I said, is a graduate of Washington U, and I'd like to welcome her now.
Thank you, Bob. And thank you, Richard, for inviting me to be part of this year. I have to thank Richard especially because I'm reading from a new piece of work that he really was instrumental in getting me started on. A few years ago, River Styx did an issue called The Last Laugh. And Richard and I shared an office out at St. Louis Community College out in Florissant when I was teaching there. And I had been telling him some stories about dealing with my mother's dementia that were both sad and humorous. And I had promised him that I would write an essay for that issue, The Last Laugh, however many years ago that was. And he kept asking me for the essay, and I kept working on the essay, and he'd ask me for the essay, and I'd work on the essay. Finally, it was clear that he was never going to get the essay because it just grew too long to be published anywhere in a short format. So it's nearing its 100-page mark now, and I'm not sure what's going to become of it in terms of publication, but I guess the best bet that is that maybe it will turn into a book. I don't know. I never really think about those along those lines when I'm writing. So this is the opening section of that piece. It's called More Than I Can Say. I'd like to say that it began with the pig on the patio, but that's not entirely true. I only tell myself that it began with the pig on the patio. In fact, it probably predated the pig on the patio. The pig on the patio just happens to be the point I always start with each time I attempt to map out the milestones of my mother's demise. Invariably, it's what I remember first. In fact, it may have begun a month earlier than that day, when the pig arrived on my parents' patio in the northern suburbs of St. Louis. It may have begun when my mother's brother died and we traveled to the Ozarks for his funeral. At the time of the funeral, it was a Saturday in early February 2005. The pig on the patio was still a part of our future, a part of the unknown world we lived in, a world that would become less and less familiar to us, one that would perplex and frustrate us, one that would continually evade our understanding. Small pews, my mother said, as I sat next to her, waiting for the funeral service to begin, my sister Mary beside me. On my mother's other side, my father shifted in the pew, his deaf ear turned toward us. "What?" he asked. "Small pews," my mother repeated. "Presbyterians," she said. And she squared her shoulders, spread her arms out a little, and squirmed as if to prove her point about the seating in this Protestant church in the Ozarks. "Large Catholics might be another way to explain it," I suggested, countering her desire to discredit the Presbyterians, if only by claiming discomfort. As a young man, my uncle had left the Catholic Church of their childhood to join the faith of his high school sweetheart, the woman he married, my aunt, seated now a few rows in front of us. His conversion was something my mother could never comprehend, a decision my uncle had made some 50 years earlier, one that my mother never held against him, holding it instead against his wife, her sister-in-law, a trickster Presbyterian who forced my uncle to trade one faith for another as if he were switching from a Chrysler to a Ford, which he also did when, as a young married man, he landed a lifelong job at General Motors. My own sister-in-law sat in the pew, the small Presbyterian pew, behind me. Raised a Methodist, she was a regular Catholic congregant now, bringing my brother, who had been lapsed in his Catholicism longer than any of us, to church each week with her, affording my mother a sight she believed she would never see again in her lifetime, a miracle, her son at Sunday Mass. Of course, my mother would never concede that my sister-in-law, by adopting the Catholic faith, had betrayed her own religious origins, the same act for which my uncle was faulted. No, that was something different. My sister-in-law's was the right course of action, the true calling, the ordained ending of any proper spiritual quest. I chided my mother about it. I laughed and joked. "Hadn't the order been restored now?" I asked her, grinning, "the advantage regained? Hadn't my sister-in-law's courting of Catholicism, for she had never officially converted, and my brother's return to it, put the numbers back in our favor? Didn't the papal Christians, in our family at least, once again outflank those Christians from that other fold?" Sometimes, if I teased her about it long enough, if I teased her about any of the things we disagreed on, she would smile slightly and nod, or she would smile and shush me away. But even during those days, gone now, distant and past, when my mother still understood irony and the undercurrents that often rippled beneath a person's words, before the time when language had been reduced to its surface value only, a time that came upon us insidiously and slyly, a slow, unnoticed leak. Even then, my attempts to point out the double standard she clung to when it came to her brother's great fall from faith, even then, back in the days when we could actually talk to each other, when our conversations could still be considered conversational, when her words weren't a babble to me, when mine weren't a mystery to her, even then, more often than not, whenever I approached the topic of the Catholic Church, my words to her would fall on ears as difficult to penetrate as my father's. My father smiled his hard of hearing smile at me, the smile that had become his response to anything said in public these past few years as he continued to resist being fitted for a hearing aid. He would nod and smile even when nothing had been said. He leaned forward toward me a little, in front of my mother, cocking his head, "Nothing," I said, and I shook my head and waved my hand dismissively, knowing that if I were to repeat my comeback about large Catholics, I would have to repeat it several times for him to understand what I was saying, each issuing growing louder and louder, each repetition causing him to shake his head again, saying, "I didn't get it," and leaning a little closer to me in an attempt to catch the next round. If he did catch it, his smile, I knew, would change from a smile of protection, one he offered the world in the hope that it would shield him from the expectation of speech, to a smile of appreciation, a smile that spoke to the quiet collaboration we had enjoyed all our lives, a dry sense of humor being my undeniable inheritance from him. He sat smiling in a world that I can only imagine as being semi-silent, one that would soon allow him to miss, mercifully maybe, much of my mother's transformation from an articulate adult to a woman whose conversational style might now be described as constant manic chatter, monochromatic chatter, interrupted occasionally by rather imperious requests, commands, some might call them. Just as the funeral service was starting, my mother turned to me and said, "You would have liked my brother." "You would have liked him too," she said to Mary, as if neither of us had known our uncle. She addressed us in a loud voice. People turned their heads in our direction. "I did like him," Mary whispered back. "I knew him. We knew him," she added. My mother's eyes widened with surprise, and then just as quickly, she narrowed her gaze and glared at us. A look of confusion and contempt flashed across her face, the two reactions arriving there simultaneously and in equal measure. I had not seen that face before on my mother. I have become accustomed to it since. The following month, the pig appeared on the patio. So no, clearly, it did not begin with the pig on the patio. But for whatever purpose is served by affixing a date to the onset of my mother's dementia, it may as well have started with the pig on the patio. For it was the pig on the patio that brought everything into focus. It was the pig on the patio that caused us, Michael, Mary, Kelly, and me, to start comparing all the peculiarities in our mother's behavior that had begun to manifest themselves in the month that passed from early February to mid-March. All the little oddities that we rolled our eyes at, all the quirks that we tried to tell ourselves were merely a handful, a sampling, a select set of our mother's many idiosyncratic eccentricities deepening with age. It was early in the morning when my mother called to tell me about the pig, early enough for me to know that she had likely not gone to bed the night before, that she had stayed up again, wandering on the first floor of the house, occupying herself with one of the obsessive activities that had consumed her of late, clipping articles from newspapers and magazines, examining the furniture, the seams of the sofa, the cushions of every chair, for evidence of the insects that bit her ankles each night without fail as soon as the 10 o'clock news ended. She'd moved from the sofa to the love seat, from the rocker to the recliner, trying to psych out the invisible invaders, but always they found her ankles, and no one else's, attacking her so severely that she could no longer enjoy Jay Leno's monologue, something that had given her pleasure each weeknight for years. "It's useless," she'd tell me, lamenting yet another loss in her life. Because of the biting, the scratching and swatting it required, she was barely able to listen to Leno, much less laugh. Ever since I can remember, my parents have been ill-matched in their sleeping habits. It is rare for my father to stay up past 10, rarer still for my mother to turn in before 2. So it was not surprising that my father did not notice the escalation of my mother's illness immediately. As with many people who have dementia, my mother suffers from sundowner syndrome. The later the hour, the less her mind can be counted upon. I finally figured out why all of my friends have deserted me, she had called at 3 a.m. one morning in mid-March to tell me. Why? I asked. It may seem that the calmness of my response glosses over much that would be worth mentioning here. Why, for example, did I not seem rattled by the phone ringing in the middle of the night? In part, I was not disturbed by it because, like my mother, I am a late-night person and I'm often up at that hour. Also, for several weeks, she had been calling me every night when the 2 a.m. rerun of that day's Oprah show was over. Nor was I alarmed by her claim of being abandoned by her friends. It was the latest of her preoccupation, a few weeks into its currency. In fact, my mother's friends were as present in her life as they had always been, but it had become futile by then to argue with my mother over any matter she swore to be true. I'm a pathological liar, she explained. What? I said. I'm a pathological liar. It's obvious to me now. A woman who appeared on Oprah that day had been sued by her friends for emotional distress after lying to them, telling them that she had a terminal illness with only a few weeks left to live. I guess my friends found out about all the lies I've been telling them, my mother said. Do you think they're going to get together to sue me? No, Mom, I said. And anyway, you aren't a pathological liar. But that's just it, she said. How would you really know? A few days later, on St. Patrick's Day, the pig appeared on the patio. My St. Patrick's Day pig, my mother called it when she phoned to say I should come right over, drive across town to play with the pig, never mind teaching my morning classes. You won't be teaching them anything today that they can't learn tomorrow, she said. That had been her attitude towards schooling all along. What you miss one day, you can always make up for the next. That, and the belief that there was much more to learn outside the classroom than in it. More field trips, she routinely suggested whenever the priest and principal of our grade school solicited input from parents. If I had been a child still when the pig arrived on the patio, if she had discovered it while I was upstairs getting dressed, putting on my plaid uniform in the room I shared with Mary, Mary, Michael, and I, Sean and Kelly later, we would have been, if not absent that day, at least late, because according to my mother, there were miracles in the world worth witnessing. Weekday matinees of resurrected movies, Gone with the Wind, for instance, movies she never expected to see on the big screen again, much less share with her children. Surely nothing in school that day could compare to viewing such a classic, or the grand opening of the first taco stand near our house. She had grown up in San Antonio and had been waiting for the day she could introduce us to tacos, never thinking of making them at home. Surely Mexican fast food was reason enough to miss school. Or the midweek, midwinter sale at Sticks, the grand leader store downtown, on Bass Weegans, the shoes we wore with our uniforms, walking up the long hill to North American Martyrs in the morning, racing back down in the late afternoon. The no exchanges no returns status of the sale required the in-person presence of our feet. Surely our shoes were important enough to miss the first few hours of classes. How could we go to school without them? Or an unseasonably warm day in winter, when all the empty parks were just waiting for people to come with a picnic. Or a new baby animal born at the zoo, her favorite place to visit. Or a day when she just needed one of us, usually me, to stay home with her a little later, to save her from a sadness that sometimes came over her suddenly without warning. Or a morning she might look out to find a pig on the patio, on St. Patrick's Day, no less. Certainly, that would be something to stay home for. Certainly, that would be something to see. Thank you.